Welcome to New World Newts. I am Kenneth Doust. These are sad and depressing times, and this lesser of two evils election is only making us even sadder and more depressed. So, as a public service, some notes of hope. The power of the people is surprisingly strong. Bad and powerful systems have been radically changed by nonviolent, popular resistance that seemed to come out of nowhere. Says who? Says Howard Zinn in 1992, and Chris Hedges in 2012, and David Rovics in between. So, if you're in the mood for a little encouragement, I hope you'll stay tuned. It's election season, and it's deep economic recession season for the 99%, though not for the all-important 1%, which is doing quite well, thank you very much. It's a season of scary chains in the Earth's climate and looming ecological catastrophe. It's a season of war, war, and more war. Wars of the United States all over the globe. More than half of all our tax dollars goes to war spending. So let's slash food stamps and Medicare and lay off teachers so we'll still have plenty of money for more war. And let's destroy civil liberties at home while we're at it. It's election time, and all the major party politicians have done a remarkable job of ignoring every problem that is destroying our lives. Except when they're promising to make the problems worse. So Romney is promising to spend even more money on war, and Obama is promising to burn more coal. And if you're feeling depressed and powerless, take heart. That's how they want us to feel, because they know that if we get energized and get together and take to the streets, it's quite possible that we will win and they will lose. We may well surprise ourselves. Historian Howard Zinn talks of how the Civil Rights Movement and the Anti-Vietnam War Movement and the Women's Movement each came as a surprise. These popular rebellions made major changes in the established order. Zinn spoke in 1992, so he couldn't take note of the Arab Spring and our Occupy movements. Two more surprises. Zinn begins with the civil rights movement of the 1960s. He's at Spelman College in segregated Atlanta. Spelman was then a private college for polite, well-mannered, colored young ladies, where the young ladies attended chapel every morning and never left campus without wearing white dress gloves. Then suddenly one day, these well-mannered, ladylike, white-gloved, bourgeois, good-colored girls were sitting in at segregated lunch counters and being dragged off to jail, and proud of it. Surprise! Who'd have thunk it? Here's Howard Zinn.
What seemed to me to be true again and again was how often surprises took place in history. Well, I know there are bad surprises, but I'm talking about good surprises. I'm talking about how often in history, when you didn't expect it, suddenly people arose and did something that you didn't expect them to do. And people there were these miners in Colorado, and year after year bowed under the oppression of the Rockefeller coal mine interests in southern Colorado, and it doesn't look like they will ever be able to utter a peep because they're surrounded by men with guns. And every time a union organizer comes into town, he's gunned down or driven out and so on. And then suddenly, one day, 13,000 of them are on the march out of their mining shacks on strike. And this has happened again and again, you know, where working people have banded together and in the 1930s taken on the great industrial giants who supposedly invincible, the Ford Empire, the General Motors Empire, the U.S. Steel Empire, taken them on and won. What happened in the civil rights movement was a surprise. Because if a lot of people looking at the South, a lot of people, looking at the South in the 1950s, well, nothing is happening. People seem to be quiet. It doesn't look like the South will ever change. Well, in fact, you know, coming to Spelman College in 1956 and seeing how controlled my students were, living in the benign paternalism of this black college which is subsidized by these white philanthropists of the North, and where the students are sort of kept under reins and sign in and sign out and compulsory chapel six times a week, and you can't do this and you can't do that, and the stone wall around the campus and barbed wire at certain points, and apparently a kind of unspoken pact between the black colleges of Atlanta and the white power structure of Atlanta, like, oh, you can have your little Negro college, fine, do as you like, but stay away from the city of Atlanta. Don't interfere with our way of life in Atlanta. Atlanta at that time was as tightly segregated as Johannesburg, South Africa. And it didn't look like anything would happen, and then suddenly one day, the students were over the wall and into the city and sitting in everywhere and getting arrested and demonstrating, and then they were never the same again. And you can take that scene and duplicate it again and again and again in Alabama and Mississippi and Southwest Georgia and all over the South in those period, that period. Surprise the social scientists who had been studying this. The anti-war movement in Vietnam was a surprise. You know, how did it start off? A handful of people protesting here and there. What chance do they have against the mighty machine of the United States? Well, that little scattered protest that started in 1964, 1965 became an enormous national movement and did something that has rarely been done in modern history. And that is an internal movement of protest being a critical factor in helping to stop a war carried on by a mighty power. Surprises. Oh, we've seen surprises in Eastern Europe, right? And who expected those things to happen? You wake up one day and there are a million people in the streets. That gives you pause when you look at a situation and say, well, nothing is happening. People are quiet. I guess they don't care. I learned just going through that, going through the civil rights movement, the anti-war, I learned never to mistake silence for acceptance. You don't know what's going on underneath. You don't know what people are holding in. You don't know that people know what's being done to them. The women's movement was a great surprise. There, too, no help from the Constitution, no Equal Rights Amendment, no help from the White House, no help from Congress. The Supreme Court only comes through with Roe v. Wade after a women's movement has grown up in the country and changed the atmosphere. You can tell things are changing. They don't change in a straight line, right? If they change in a straight line, it would be easy to tell. They zig and zag and they confuse us, you know. But they, you know, they do change. Well, it's good to keep in mind that very often the other side, they, them, the people on top, the people in control, have a better sense of the power of ordinary people than these people themselves have. That's why they get so hysterical, you know. Right? I mean, why have they had all these years the FBI rushing around taking everybody's name? They're scared. They're always scared. You know, they're worried. You know, why does Nixon go, there's one picket going around the White House during the Vietnam War, and Nixon goes bananas. Right? Do you remember? And have you noticed, those of you who have ever been on even a little picket line, and suddenly there are 12 cops around, to surround three people, you know. What are they getting excited about? they know that little acts lead to big ones. They know that. They know that any little thing that people do might lead to something else. They know that great movements come out of countless tiny acts that people engage in. Sure, there are people who do heroic things, and that's wonderful, but very few people can do heroic things, but most everybody can do something small. And the small things, which are unknown, you have to look hard in history to see these links and roots and connections. But the small things that people do connect with other things, and you don't even know when you do something small. Whatever you do, whether you sign a petition or stand on a picket line or defy your boss or refuse military service or say something to somebody, you don't know what effect you're having and how things build up. But, you know, they worry about it. That's why they worry about multiculturalism in the curriculum. This is, you know, they worry about Marxist professors in the colleges. You know, Marxist professors are taking over. I was very heartened when I read that. When I wanted to cheer myself up, I used to read J. Edgar Hoover. Because with him, you know, the structure of society was always in imminent danger.
Historian Howard Zinn on the surprising and successful popular rebellions beginning in the 1960s. Chris Hedges brings us up to date. As a journalist, he saw firsthand the popular uprisings that ended Soviet-controlled communism in East Germany and in Czechoslovakia. He tells an inspiring story of two Czechs who, independently, joined the pro-democracy rebellion of 1968. That rebellion was put down by the Warsaw Pact. But the acts of disobedience of these two, and of thousands of others, helped inspire the popular rebellion of Czechs in 1989, and that one was successful. The two names were Jan Palach and Martha Kubishaya. But first, let's hear of Mohamed Bouazizi. He was nobody special, a young, poor produce vendor in Tunisia during the days of the dictator Ben Ali. Abused by the police, unable to get justice from the government, he set himself on fire in protest in December 2010. Then the surprise. His fate inspired tens of thousands to take to the streets, demanding justice, freedom, and democracy. The Arab Spring was born. The dictator Ben Ali quit after 23 years in power. Days later, the Egyptians also rose, and their dictator, Mubarak, resigned. We all remember those photos and videos, right? Hundreds of thousands of nonviolent demonstrators in Tahrir Square, demanding change and getting it. Chris Hedges will tell us about Leipzig and Prague, and Jan Palach and Martha Kubishaya. But first, let's hear some of the story of Tunisia's Mohamed Bouazizi. It's beautifully told by David Rovics.
Maybe there was something he could do. Word came from on high, we don't talk to people like you. Mohamed Bouazizi, I was living on a wire. Went and bought some paint thinner, and he set himself on fire. Word spread through the region, soon you'd hear it same. Proud and desperate people, going up in flames. Sometimes windows open, sometimes the floor it creaks. But no one knew what would happen in only a few weeks. When the dictator ran away, when the dictator ran away, met them there with truncheons and bullets to the head. this is just what happens to a dream deferred. The police kept up the attack, thousands wounded, hundreds killed. With blood the streets were covered, with gas the air was filled. But the people held their ground, Tunisia's daughters and their sons. One day the cops had had enough, they just put down their guns. When the dictator ran away,
I covered movements around the globe, all of the revolutions in Eastern Europe, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania, all of the street demonstrations that brought down Slobodan Milosevic, the first Palestinian uprising or intifada, the second Palestinian uprising that took place about 5 years later. And I've learned that movements are organic. They have a life, a kind of centrifugal force, that even the purported leaders of those movements do not understand or grasp. The fundamental task of the security and surveillance state, and all of these movements took place in states that had draconian forms of control, the Stasi in East Germany, for instance, although I would argue that at this point, the security and surveillance state in the United States is the most repressive apparatus, an intrusive apparatus, probably in human history. Their fundamental goal is to sever a movement which articulates the truth, as Occupy did, from the mainstream. And my book, The Death of the Liberal Class, chronicles the destruction of populist and radical movements that were the force in this society that opened up democracy, that provided all the true correctives to American democracy. It never came from the white power elite. It came from the bottom. The Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, None of these movements achieve formal positions of power. And yet, in April 1968, one could argue that Martin Luther King was the most powerful figure in this country until his assassination, because when he went to Memphis, 50,000 people went with him. And what has happened to Occupy is that the external forces of repression have been matched by sophisticated and deep internal forces of repression. And the goal is to sever the movement from the mainstream, to make the mainstream frightened of the movement. What terrified the power elite were the mothers and fathers from the suburbs outside of New York showing up in Zuccotti Park with their strollers. Because they knew that if this movement spread, if it could begin to pull the kinds of numbers that I saw in Leipzig and Alexanderplatz and Wenceslas Square, the pillars, which are fragile, that hold up the systems of power, including the foot soldiers of the elite, the police, could be internally divided, and internal division creates paralysis. So I'm not a pacifist. I was in Sarajevo during the war when it was being hit with 2,000 shells a day, constant sniper fire, 4 to 5 dead a day, 2 dozen wounded a day, 45 of my own foreign journalists killed. And we were surrounded by a trench system and understood that if the Serbs broke through that trench system, a third of the city would be slaughtered and the rest would end up in refugee and displacement camps. And that wasn't theory, because all we had to do was look at Vukovar or the Drina Valley. At that moment, I understand why you pick up a weapon. And yet, I believe that at this moment, our true power, as Václav Havel wrote, comes, whatever that incongruity is, from our powerlessness. I think that is our greatest weapon. We cannot compete internally or externally with the forces of the security and surveillance state that were on public display last night, because they can't allow this movement to take root again. Orwell said that all totalitarian societies rule through fraud and force, and now that fraud has been exposed, and force is all they have left. When I was in Leipzig, there would be candlelit vigils every week, run mostly out of the Lutheran Church, 70 people, 100 people, and then suddenly 70,000 people. Even the organizers of that movement didn't know why. At that moment, people broke through the barriers of fear implanted by the Stasi state to join them. And Honecker, Erich Honecker, the dictator, called on an elite paratroop division to go down to Leipzig and fire on the crowd. And when their paratroopers got there, they refused. Honecker was gone within a week. It is the pillars. The corruption and rot within the corporate state is so extensive. And believe me, those within that elite understand how corrupt power is, how gamed power is, far better than anyone in this room. And so do those cops, who for $37 an hour have to work as rent-a-cops or rent-a-security guards at places like Goldman Sachs, and watching these guys in their $8,000 suits walk by them as if they're invisible. The power we have comes through transparency. It comes through true democracy. It comes through consensus. And it comes through nonviolence. At this moment, that is the most potent weapon we have. And the security state will seek to paint us another way. Every act of violence is used by the propaganda machine to frighten the mainstream from joining the movement and justify brutal tactics of police repression. Never underestimate the power of the good to draw the good. When I was in Prague covering the Velvet Revolution every evening in the Magic Lantern Theater with Václav Havel and Klaus and all of those who would finally inherit the government of Czechoslovakia when the communists fell. There were posters throughout the streets of Prague of a student named Jan Panic, who in 1968, to protest the Soviet invasion of his country, lit himself on fire in Wenceslas Square, and 4 days later died of his burns. When students from Charles University joined the funeral procession, they were broken up by police. The event was never mentioned on the state-controlled media. When his grave became a shrine, they dug up his remains, cremated his body, gave the cremated urns to his mother, and told her that she was not allowed to bury them. 3 weeks after the government fell, 10,000 people were in Red Army Square to rename it in his honor. I was in Wenceslas Square with 500,000 people when Marta Kubashaya, who was Czechoslovakia's most popular singer and in 1968, sang an anthem of defiance that saw her once the communist regime was cemented back into place and Juček was overthrown, turned into a non-person, her recording stock was destroyed. Her voice did not appear on the airwaves. She survived by working in a factory that made toys on an assembly line. And when she walked out on that balcony on that winter's night and began to sing, every person around me knew every word. The power of truth, the power of love, not the sentimental love, but the love that Martin Luther King talked about. This is the power that Occupy has harnessed, and it is a power that terrifies the state. With that power, if we hold fast to it, I believe we have the capacity to bring these people down. Thank you.
Chris Hedges, reminding us of the surprising power of the people. Both Hedges and Zinn both say it's not the ballot or the bullet that changes the system. What produces change we can believe in is nonviolent popular resistance. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, and I approve this message. And I thank you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illigit my non-carborundum, and to the barricades. But let's leave the rifle back at home. Peace.